Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Movie Geeks United. Tonight, the Movie Geeks welcome one of our greatest film composers, whose breathtaking scores for Lions for Lambs, In the Valley of Ella, and Reservation Road can currently be heard on the big screen, Mr. Mark Isham. Plus, the latest developments with the writer's strike, and the most exciting movie news of the week. Got a question for the geeks or tonight's guests? Give us a call at 718-508-9477 or log on to our chat room now. Are you ready to get your geek on? Here are your hosts for tonight's episode of Movie Geeks United, Jamie and Jerry.
Welcome to Movie Geeks United. I wish I had like an angelic choir to.
I know. I mean, you really need that
to accompany me there. It's a great show we got for you tonight. My name is Jamie, and Jerry. How are you?
My name is Jerry, and welcome to our show.
Yeah, it's an exciting night. We've been looking forward to having this guest on for the past few weeks, ever since we confirmed him. He'll be calling in just a second, and we'll bring him on the line. It's a great honor to have him on our show tonight. And
absolutely.
Also an honor, you know, I've been speaking to his people throughout the day, and we arranged, I don't know what we want to call it, I'm calling it a World Internet Radio Premiere, which also would an angelic choir would also help out there if we had.
We need to get on this. We need to get some, hire some people.
Maybe Mark Isham can write something for us. A world internet radio premiere of the Lions for Lambs theme. I've been like I said in the previous shows, I've been living with his music for as long as I've loved movies and been collecting soundtracks. But
right.
Particularly this past two or three weeks, because he's just come out with some amazing work.
He's very prolific.
Very much so, and just breathtaking work, and I knew the second I heard the Lions for Lambs theme, I thought to myself, "Oh, I'm going to wear the CD out." You know, there are just some things that are so instantly listenable and fascinating. You know, you just have to go back time and time again and explore it. So that's great. A couple of notes tonight. As usual, you can subscribe to our show through iTunes and a variety of feeds. Actually, they're called RSS feeds. Not sure what that is. Do you have any idea what that is, Jerry?
Yeah, I have, like, tons of them. I think I have, like, tons of them for a couple of the entertainment blogs and a couple of our friends' blogs. And
tell them what happens when they subscribe.
They subscribe. I use, like, if I have a Mozilla browser, a Firefox, and it will be on the top of the screen, and there's a little RSS icon, and let's say, all right, for Movie Geeks, they'll just have a little icon at the top, and they can click on it, and a drop-down menu of all our previous shows will be on it. So that's what it's just like. It's the whole subscription of like that person's blog or whatever, and it will come, at least on my browser.
Well, thank you for clearing that up. You know, I honestly co-host the show. I do a lot of stuff.
Let's specify. You do everything. Jamie gets the guest. He gets the topics. He's the brainchild of this whole operation. So
yeah, it's the only part of my life.
Hangs out with David Letterman.
Yeah, it's the only part of my life where I actually show that I have a brain.
Bullshit! Don't say that. But
I know nothing about computers really. But anyway, you can subscribe through iTunes as well, and it'll automatically be uploaded onto your iTunes system every archived episode, every upcoming episode. And talk about some great episodes we've had lately. Last week we welcomed Brian De Palma, legendary filmmaker.
Yeah, I mean, big.
I know, very big.
And we had Howard Shore.
Howard Shore. Oh, we love film composers.
Yeah.
Howard Shore, John Ottman, and of course tonight's guest. But probably the best hour you'll hear on the most controversial film of the year, which is Redacted, and that took place last week. You can access the archives for that. And last Sunday's show, which was a celebration of the 25th anniversary of the film Poltergeist, which actually we'll discuss a little bit later. We've been getting a lot of press for that one.
Yes, we have.
Yes, it's been kind of a firestorm here lately. And this Sunday we have Pamela Douglas, the author of Writing the TV Drama. She'll be talking about what goes into writing a successful television drama series, and we'll get some insights from her on the current writer's strike as well. And we'll be covering in our home entertainment segment two new DVD releases, Hearts of Darkness, which is the documentary on the making of Apocalypse Now, which is one of the most fantastic, fascinating documentaries you'll ever
see. Yes, it is.
And a movie called Killer of Sheep, which is very interesting. It's the first time available on DVD. Very influential movie, 1977. It was made by an independent film student at UCLA, Charles Burnett. And he made it for something like $5,000, and it's been the Library of Congress declared it a national treasure as one of the first 50 on the National Film Registry, and the National Society of Film Critics selected it as one of the 100 essential films of all time. Amazing story. We'll have the we'll be discussing the DVD with the star of the film, Henry Sanders, and that's all this Sunday. All right, are you ready?
Yes, I'm ready.
Let's do this. Last month, Mark Isham was awarded the Composer of the Year honor at the annual Hollywood Film Festival. The award was well-deserved, if only for the astounding fact that Isham's creative output for 2007 includes unforgettable scores for a whopping 7 feature films, including Freedom Riders, Gracie, Next, Lions for Lambs, and the Valley of Ella, Reservation Road, Frank Darabont's upcoming film The Mist, and that's not even counting his work for the entire first season of Paul Haggis's The Black Donnellys television series. In fact, upon review of Mr. Isham's remarkable resume, it's hard not to categorize him as the composer of the past quarter century, having meticulously crafted a series of extraordinary scores for films as diverse as The Hitcher, Romeo is Bleeding, Blade, Night Falls in Manhattan, Quiz Show, Rules of Engagement, Crash, The Black Dahlia, In Her Shoes, and A River Runs Through It, for which he earned an Academy Award nomination. It is a tremendous honor for all of us here at Movie Geeks United to welcome to the show Mr. Mark Isham. Mr. Isham, are you with us?
I am. Thank you very, very much.
Thank you very much for being with us. It's a great treat to speak with you tonight.
Oh, well, likewise. A great treat to be here.
How about this career no doubt you've had an exceptional career, but
it's been going pretty well. Yeah.
Yeah, this year seems to just be crazy for you. Your 7 projects, and
this last year has been a pretty exceptional year, and especially the quality and the new relationships, old relationships have come around to be, Paul Haggis making a new film, Robert Redford making a film. I mean, these are pretty extraordinary opportunities for me. I'm just glad to be here and have the opportunity to join them.
Yeah, and you've worked with both several times, and talk about great collaborators to have on your side. I mean, that's as good as it gets.
Well, it is. I mean, I've been thinking about that recently, that really one of the great joys of this profession is that collaboration. I mean, filmmaking, I think, is the true collaborative art form, but it always needs a great captain, to captain that ship. And
yeah,
I've been very, very fortunate in my career to have worked with some of the best. I mean, you mentioned Brian De Palma. I mean, I did The Black Dahlia for him a year ago, and it's going well.
Well, I would definitely want to ask you about all of these high-profile collaborations and your process, but tell us a little bit about how your musical education began.
Well, I was very fortunate. I was born into a family that was very musical. My mother is still a professional violinist up in the San Francisco Bay Area, and my father is a professor of history and the humanities. So I was a lot of music around the house. And at a young age, my mother would drag me into a lot of orchestra rehearsals, and I discovered the trumpet. I thought it was the coolest instrument in the orchestra, loud, bold, I thought that was for me, so I became a trumpet player and worked professionally, and of course still have a trumpet playing career that I managed to hold on to. If the film work does lets up occasionally, and I just loved music, all sorts of genres. I have a background in classical music, but I discovered jazz at a very early age, and I also discovered electronic music actually at a very early age, and sort of those three elements, I just continued to sort of bounce around and explore through my 20s. It included, of course, playing in more pop rock bands just to make a living.
Mm-hmm.
So by the time I reached my late 20s, early 30s, I had probably, a pretty impressive education in music, more or less just by doing it and being involved in it.
Right.
And at that time, the timing was really good because a film director, Mr. Carol Ballard, heard a piece of music that I had written and said, that's what I've been looking for. I didn't know how to describe it, but that's it. That's what this film needs. And he tracked me down and offered me the opportunity to score Never Cry Wolf.
Never Cry Wolf, exactly, yeah.
And, I had no training in film music whatsoever, but I realized this was a tremendous opportunity, and I should grab it, and I should do everything I possibly can to complete it.
So had you given any thought previous to that about film composing?
Not really. I think at one time, I think a dance company had approached me, and I'd written one piece for a dance company. And so I knew that there was professions out there that, you know, that one could do that, where you wrote music to accompany image. And obviously, I went to movies, and I knew that I was a fan of Henry Mancini and John Williams, and I knew the big names. But for some reason, it's never been a career choice for me until it was sort of thrust at me.
Yeah.
And then I just said, well, why not? Let me just try it. And it was a remarkable experience. I found that, I think just to find that somebody wants you to compose instrumental music and wants to pay to have it recorded well was such a unique experience. You know, that I said, well, this is quite something. Maybe I should look into this. And the rest sort of was history.
Well, the process just fascinates me. And I want you to take me through the process of, as best you can, of scoring a picture. And let's take, if you don't mind, Lions for Lambs, which I've had on repeat. I said at the beginning of the show, I'm going to wear the CD out because I'm in love with the score. So you sit down and you watch the picture and you get first impressions. Tell me what starts to come together for you when you try to find a musical voice for that film.
Well, Lions for Lambs, it was quite interesting. I met with Bob and actually went to the set when he was still shooting the last parts of the movie. And so I had a chance to get a sense of what he was doing there and met with him for a couple of hours afterwards and heard, you know, what he was looking for. And the meeting must have gone well and reaffirmed that you know, that we worked well together, because he hired me immediately after that. And then he said, look, let me get some rough assembly done, and then we should talk further.
Right.
And I went up to his place in Northern California about a month or so later, and he had about 5 scenes assembled. And he said, look, we put some music in here, and I think you should hear it, because it's not what I was expecting. And he was right, because it was not what I was expecting either. I thought when I read the script that this would be not too dissimilar to Valley of Elah or Crash. You know, it was intimate piece. There were no more than 2 or 3 people in a room at the same time. Even the more action-oriented stuff is just 2 guys and they're stuck. They're not moving. Nothing. You know, not a lot of things are happening viscerally in the script. And yet somehow the way that Joe Hutching was cutting it together, it had tremendous momentum. And they had put some very, very rhythmic music in the front of the picture, and I just looked at Bob and said, you know, all my intellectual instincts would have said that would be wrong, but it's great. It's just great. It does a lot for this movie. And we both agreed right from there that the score was going to be bigger and more just different, you know, very different than any sort of initial analysis from the script would yield you to believe.
Yeah. It seems to be very similar to Crash in the movie itself, and that it's a movie of ideas and these kind of interweaving stories.
Well, exactly, and the score for Crash is quite delicate.
Yeah,
and sort of floats above the movie.
Yeah,
and which was perfect for that movie, and one which, you know, we came to with a little experimentation, and it became very clear to Paul and I after not much experimentation that was really the most effective way to do it. This film is the exact opposite. I mean, we charge into this thing as if it's a Tony Scott thriller.
Exactly, yeah.
And it works. And then I must say the score just does change gears. But what's interesting about the structure of this score is that it changes gears gradually. After the first reel and a half, those harder-edged electronic sounds start to gradually, you know, every cue they're a little less. And every cue, the orchestra starts to take more of a major role. So that by the time you get to the last reel and a half, the orchestra has really stepped up, and you really feel a large, organic, very emotional presence, emotional in a very traditional way. And by the last, you know, the penultimate scene, electronics have, for all intents and purposes, faded out. The full orchestra has stepped forth. There's a woman's choir has arrived, and we have a very, you know, intensely emotional ending. It's done in the sense of using a large orchestra for that in a traditional way, although the music itself, I think, is definitely not traditional.
Yeah, it's a fantastic piece of work. Now, you mentioned that they used a temp score. How do you, what's your perspective on the use of temp scores? Is it helpful? Do you kind of resent it because you can't start with a blank slate? Or?
I don't resent it. I find more often than not that they do have some help, even for me. Occasionally they can become problematic, and because I've been doing this for a little while now, I've sort of got some tricks up my sleeve of how to solve the problems of temp love, for instance. You know,
right.
A director or filmmaking team who've just fallen in love with an earlier piece of music and can't get it out of their mind that this is the only way to do it. So barring you know, things like that, it's actually quite helpful because it is very difficult to verbalize music.
Mm-hmm.
And I find that you know, all the talking in the world sometimes can't really explain the sensation that you're getting from a particular piece of music in a particular place that you couldn't begin to explain to somebody how, you know, what that is. And it's just much easier to play. You see the interaction here, and then I can analyze that and figure out, well, what are the elements that are creating this effect, and then I can ditch the specifics and use the general ideas, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Having said that, there is something wonderful about diving into a picture which you've never seen any music except something that you create for it originally. But once again, I think I've out of experience, I can sort of recreate that for myself. I can take a day off from writing, and then I come back and just look at the picture with no music and pretty much sort of mock up that effect again for myself if I want to do that.
Yeah. Well, you currently have two other projects that are in theaters and in stores as well, and that's in the Valley of Ella and Reservation Road. Mm-hmm. And I'm wondering, when you're composing these pictures, I mean, I'm sure that you almost have to find yourself living in the picture in a sense.
It's very true, and that's an interesting way of describing it. I think that's pretty spot on. I was trying to describe it the other day, actually, and described it similarly in that you want to get into that universe. You know, a good filmmaker creates a very specific universe that story is unfolding in, and that's why it's very important for me to start writing once I have a picture. I find it very difficult to write from just a script.
Yeah,
I like to see the fabric of this universe. The colors of it, you know, the size of it. Is it shot so that everything seems very constricted and tight and small and introverted? Or is it shot so it's wide open and things seem limitless? I mean, those are very important sensations to take into account for music. I mean, space is a big element that music can contribute to,
mm-hmm.
and needs to be a part of in a correct balance. So, yeah, it's that image. And as you say, it's living that life that the story is telling, being in that universe. I throw myself into it, and once the musical universe is defined, then it starts to flow, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Then I can write, you know, sad music or happy music or reconciliatory music or whatever it needs to be in that vocabulary of that universe.
Yeah. Do you find too that the best directors are the ones with the strongest musical sense?
It doesn't have to be specifically musical sense, but it has to be a real sense of emotion and how it works, and not a contrived sense of how it works, but a real ability to have looked at life and see how it really works, you know. And one of the great things about working with Bob Redford is that he is such a fine actor, and he really can look at a character and a character's experience in a storytelling and describe that arc as to what's happened, you know, what's happened before, what's happening precisely at these moments, and where are we headed, and where's that character, you know, the evolution, emotional evolution of this character. And I find someone who can articulate those things well and pinpoint, you know, the points in a story that connect and the way that the emotions transfer from one character to another, or one scene to another, and all these fine points of a story. If they can just communicate that to me, I can translate it into music.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, sometimes it's better that they don't try and do it. that they just leave that to me. So I find, and Haggis is the same way. He's such a great writer that he can look at and feel, you know, and be very precise. You know, at this moment, Mark, even though, you know, things are exploding, what's happening in this person's head is this, right?
Mm-hmm.
And the music, I want the music inside their head, so I need you to do this. And insight into it like that is what's really the most valuable.
Mm-hmm. I was going to ask you about Redford and Haggis, and you've already spoken to them, but let me ask you about a couple of the other collaborators, directors that you've worked with. I know Frank Darabont, you've composed for him a couple of times, and the latest is with The Mist.
Yeah.
And what a treat was that to score essentially a great monster movie.
Well, it is, you know, and it's really a first time that I've done a real, just no-holds-barred monster movie.
Yeah.
and Frank, you know, is very upfront about that in talking about the film himself. He says, you know, it's a low-budget horror film, kids, and we're having the time of our life. Of course, the truth of the matter is that, you know, Frank is just one of the all-time great writers and directors, and in his hands, you know, a very simple horror story, although, you know, masterfully told, of course, by one of the great master horror storytellers.
Right.
But turned into a film, again, by a real master, it rises way above that genre and becomes really quite something extraordinary. And, I mean, Frank is again, one of very, very similar in that way that he loves music, he respects music tremendously. He'll leave the translation to me. And
mm-hmm.
But he is so tuned into his storytelling and so tuned into exactly where things change and how characters, you know, their internal struggles versus their external struggles and how all of this ties together and where things, you know, should bend and twist you know, he's a great navigator through those things and can point out all the spots that need to be pointed out.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and you can definitely see that in his work, what a master storyteller he is.
Oh, just one of the finest.
Yeah, and of course, we mentioned it a little earlier, but I have to ask you about your experience with De Palma on The Black Dahlia, because you talk about just a visual artist. I mean, his films are just visual feasts that must be incredible to compose to those.
Yes, yeah. I mean, working with De Palma was really tremendous because he's actually quite very different from, you know, some of these other directors. He is, in a sense, very, well, you see it in his filmmaking style. He's very sort of black and white. You know, things are big, gestures are big. It's like, bam, bam. Okay, now we're here. No, now we're here. And now we're doing this, and now we're doing this. And then just when you thought we were going to do this, no, we're going to do the exact opposite. And therefore, it's sort of liberating score-wise because you can follow him in those big gestures.
Yeah.
And, you know, things that I would never do in a Paul Haggis or a Terry George movie, you know, you can just do with wild abandon in a Brian De Palma movie. And, in fact, you know, I had to push myself to be bigger and bolder and even more extravagant. But then also the level of detail that he has in his image. I found that orchestrationally was really inspired me, I really wanted to find an orchestral vocabulary that was unique and very, how should I say this, emotionally raw, but at the same time very sophisticated in its structure. And so there was a lot of Leonard Bernstein influence, and just, I had a blast on that score.
Well, it utilizes the trumpet.
Well, yes, I hired somebody I know pretty well to play the trumpet, and convinced him he had to practice.
it reminded me, not that the score sounds like it, but because of the time period of the film and the use of the trumpet, I thought back on Chinatown, the crew.
Absolutely.
Yeah, I thought about that myself and said, well, what the hell, I'm going to brave it.
So tell me how the computer has changed what you do, that technology.
Well, it makes a certain part of the score writing process quicker. Certainly access to a wide variety of sounds, when you're demoing, for yourself and then demoing for the filmmakers, you know, you have basically at your fingertips, well, if you go spend a couple of days designing things and organizing things well, pretty much anything you can imagine, which of course is very different than 10, 15 years ago when it would take, you know, days to put together a studio that could create demos of that sophistication.
Yeah.
Which of course is a tremendous boon, and it really helps the demo process. It really helps inspiring confidence in the filmmakers that you're on the right track. They can hear, with very little exception, I think, almost a fully realized mock-up of a score that doesn't leave a lot to the imagination. And this, of course, is very good for nervous filmmakers and nervous producers and nervous studios, and especially if you're spending a lot of their money. They're very happy about that, and I'm happy too, because then the recording sessions are much more relaxed.
Yeah.
So I think in general the process is and the technology that we have is good for the process. The one thing that I have to constantly remind myself, though, is to not get lulled into that the instruments that you're writing for are so much more capable than the fake versions that I have in the studio.
Right.
And not to forget that the orchestra is capable of a lot more, and to know that there's a part two to the writing, that I can write something, present it as a demo, know that they love it, but know that after that then that I really have to push myself and the orchestrators to let the final score rise as high above that as possible, and not just get sort of stuck in the electronic world.
Yeah. I had a question for you that I always tend to ask one question that's just off the wall and embarrasses me, but this might be one of them. I've heard actors say that when they read a scene, there's often an obvious way to play the scene, but when they try to play it the exact opposite way, it kind of makes it more interesting and it kind of brings out a deeper truth to the moment. As a composer, are you looking for ways to avoid the obvious musical cliches and can you give me an example of an instance where you did this, kind of created a musical counterpoint, I guess you'd say?
Well, the basic answer to that question is yes. I mean, I am always looking for a different way of doing it. I'm trying to think of some. I mean, obviously, I remember there was one point I don't remember if I actually remember the film, but. And this has been a way that other directors have done it the not obvious way too. But you know, like a heavy war scene, for instance, all of a sudden the battle sounds and the heavy action music fade out, and you might just have a choir singing a very simple hymn, right? Things like that can be incredibly powerful. I mean, I remember Oliver Stone, I think, does something like that in one of his earlier movies, and I did that at one point in. I can't remember exactly, but there are moments in Valley of Elah like that where, you know, Paul wanted just sort of things to fall away, and of course the ending of Lions for Lambs. I can't say that we got small, but there is a moment, the penultimate moment in Lions for Lambs.
Yeah.
If people hadn't seen it, I won't give it away. But there's a scene where what you're looking at visually is just tremendously loud. I mean, just like. Would be breaking your eardrums, and the sound just drifts away into nothingness, and the orchestra just is playing.
Yeah, it's a gorgeous moment.
Yeah, moments like that are priceless for a composer, especially when the director says, you know, that's what I think I'm going to do here. You say, oh boy, this is now it's all up to me.
Yeah.
And a little unnerving at first, but what a challenge and what an opportunity, you know.
Oh, yeah.
Excuse me, I have a question.
Sure.
Yeah, I just wanted to, you work with Alan Rudolph a lot. In the past, and I'm just curious, what is it like to work with him?
Well, Alan was my first sort of, long-term relationship. My third film was an Alan Rudolph film, and he was just sort of getting on a roll. As a young director, he'd just come out of working a lot with Robert.
Actually, that's one of my favorites, Trouble in Mind.
That was the first one that I did, yeah.
I love that film.
Oh, thank
Great
you.
Film.
Well, see, I'd gone to see Choose Me.
That's another one.
Which was, I think, his first breakout movie on his own.
Mm-hmm.
Not his first movie, but the first one that really...
The first one that got everyone's attention.
Exactly. And it got my attention. I came back and said to my agent, I saw this movie over the weekend. I want to work with this guy. And strangely enough, Alan had just turned a record of mine and had phoned his producer and said, "Does this guy write film scores?" So it was, and that's the way our relationship was for, I don't know, God, 10, 11 films I think we've done.
Mm.
Just very, we think alike. He is one of the most improvisational film directors that I've ever worked with.
I think it's always an event when a film of his, you know, comes out. I mean, he's a very unique director.
Yeah. And we just hit it off right from the beginning. You know, he'd be one of the ones that would be willing for me just to hire a band and then, you know, write a few tunes and then let them sort of improvise these tunes as a score. You know, he would love ideas like that.
Great.
Because he would do scenes like that. He would say, this is a scene I don't want to know exactly how this is going to go. I just want to tell the characters that this is what they got to come out of this room having achieved this, and just let them do it. You know?
Yeah.
Cool.
And that's brave. Film
that is.
That is very, and it's harder and harder to do. In fact, I don't know if anybody can get away with it anymore. But, you know, it was a remarkable experience working with someone like that who's willing to think like that and willing to, you know, let you create a score like that.
Right.
Mr. Isham, we have a question for you from our chat room from a listener by the name of Neo.
Okay.
And first of all, he wants to make it clear he believes that you are a genius, and he's very giddy just listening to you.
I think Neo's a she, actually.
I'm sorry. Neo says, and I hope I read this question correctly, have you considered collaborating with George Winston again?
Actually, that hasn't come up, no. In fact, I'm not quite sure where George is these days. I know that... you know, he founded his record label and got very involved in that, and I hadn't heard that he'd actually been playing much anymore. I could be completely wrong. I'm just sort of out of touch with George's life and don't really know.
Okay.
Okay.
And Neo is a she. I'm so sorry. I've apologized to her on the chat room. Is there a community among film composers? Do you communicate often with each other or follow each other's work?
Well, I think we follow each other's work. I mean, I certainly know that I look at other film composers' work. I like to see to sort of see, because, you know, like any profession that's evolving, I mean, it is evolving, and there are trends and styles and things that are considered the way to do things for a while, and then all of a sudden it's, you know, oh, we don't do that anymore, you know.
Right.
But it's actually a pretty lonely profession in the sense that the real nuts and bolts work of it are done by yourself in a room, usually late at night, and the quieter the better. So we don't really get a chance to hang out with each other a lot because there's very, very seldom are there more than one composer on a film. And even if there are, you're probably writing by yourselves and then, you know, show and tell what you've done to each other.
Yeah.
I really enjoy it when I do have a chance. I remember the first time that I met Hans Zimmer. I said, well, we need to have lunch, and we managed to have two lunches, I think, in 10 years, but we really do enjoy it when we do. And I finally met Michael Dana and Rolf Kent the other night, which was really a blast because it was great to meet them because they're very unique and wonderful composers.
I know that when we spoke to Howard Shore, he talked about he's going into opera. He's done an opera for The Fly. And I was wondering, is there something that you're dying to do, a dream that has not yet been fulfilled?
Well, my dreams are still in the trumpet-playing side of the world and the performing side. I still find that having a band that is a close-knit band where we understand each other well musically and that we have the same sort of goals to create sort of a conversational, improvisational music in front of an audience. Because I've had these bands before.
Yeah.
And when they're at the top of their game and you on tour and doing a series of, you know, great venues playing music like this, there's really nothing else better as far as I'm concerned. But the sensation of putting yourself out there on this sort of creative tightrope, you know, not having it, you know, predetermined and exactly rehearsed down to the 16th note, knowing that you're going out to create this stuff totally fresh and virtually brand new, but that you trust the people that you're with and you're willing to go out in front of, you know, thousands of people and do this, and then pulling it off, there's really very little like that for me.
Yeah, there's nothing like the thrill of live performance.
Yeah, and so I still... You know, one of the reasons I'm a father now of four children, so film composing is a great, you know, creative outlet for me, and it's a nice job, and it keeps me home with my children. I think as the children grow up, I will probably try to, shift the balance again of my career back to more performing, because,
mm-hmm.
and that's probably my dream.
Yeah,
I would have to say one of the things that I have experimented with is bringing film and the larger ensembles into that. I've done some evenings of with orchestras where we project film, and yet there's still this sort of improvisational core, and that's really exciting. So, although I can't really articulate a specific dream, it's probably along those lines to really work. And I can see why Howard, you know, get back into the concert hall, you know, get back into the live music. It's so vital and so. So much fun for everybody. The audience certainly has a great time.
Oh, yeah. It must be a thrill. Mr. Isham, you've been so nice to us, giving us so much time tonight. Can I accept one call for you, and then we'll wrap things up?
Certainly.
860 area code. Go right ahead.
Oh, my name is Tony Harrington. I've been following you for years. Isham, I'm surprised you have that, did a conceptual album like Vapor Drawing. There's a new age side of you that's how I discovered you. Have you ever thought about doing something like that again?
It crosses my mind, yeah. I'm actually working on two albums right now, whenever I manage to find a spare weekend or something from the film work.
It's hard with seven films in a year.
Yeah, it is very, very hard. And I've, you know, three sons in school that playing sports, and there's games to go to. I mean,
oh wow,
there's a lot to do here. But I still like I've expressed my love for live music, and part of being able to get out there and accept live concerts is having an album out there. It sort of creates the momentum for booking tours and concerts.
Mm-hmm.
So the albums are important. I can't say that a specific sort of new age record is in the offing. I am working on an album of jazz standards, but put into a very different settings, almost settings where you can't really tell what the original song was at first.
Huh.
And it sort of unfolds like a surprise package. And it is very electronic. Basically, at this point, it's just trumpet with electronics only. And then there's a few guest artists. You know, Sid Page comes and plays violin, and I'm planned a few others. So I can't say it's stylistically New Age, but it is trumpet and electronics. It does have that similarity. And then there's a original composition album underway, too, that's a little more sort of acid jazzy, remix, you know, a little more groove-oriented.
Oh, wow. Can't wait. Yeah. When do those come out?
Well, really, you know, when I find the time. At this point, we're not going to make it this year. I wanted to try and at least get one of them out this year. It doesn't look like I'll, but I hope to get the albums done this year and both out next year for sure.
And on the film composing front, what do you have upcoming?
Currently, I'm working on a wonderful film, a Dennis Quaid film directed by Gary Flader, the story of Ernie Davis, the first black Heisman Trophy winner.
Hmm.
Well, that should be good.
Which I'm actually sort of constantly on the lookout for football movies because I have two sons who both play football. One at a very, very high level, so it's almost like a family thing. Oh, Dad can score a football movie, then it's involved, you know.
Well,
so that thus you see, you know, a fair number of football movies scattered over the last couple of years, also.
Right.
Yeah, yeah. Well, we look forward to all of that, Mr. Isham. Thank you so much for being with us tonight.
Thank you.
It's been a great pleasure to speak with you, and please come back to us anytime you want in the future.
Well, I did very much enjoy that. It's been a great pleasure for me, too.
Thank you so much,
Thank
sir.
You.
Right. Bye-bye
Good
now.
Bye, gentlemen.
That is legendary composer Mark Isham. And in a few minutes, oh, and thank you so much to the 860 area code caller. Thank you for joining us tonight and calling in with your question. A little bit later on the show, we'll be providing the World Internet Radio premiere of Mr. Isham's terrific Lions for Lambs theme. That'll be in the last 20 minutes of the show, or 2 minutes of the show to close the show out.
Okay, cool.
It is cool. And thank you to him so much.
Of course.
And for arranging the interview and Blog Talk Radio, because I've been emailing them back and forth, telling them the wonderful news lately about all the great guests, including Mr. Isham, that we've had, and they've been phenomenal to us as well, and I want to take the opportunity to thank them as well. Okay, Jerry, what's going on in movie news this week? We got a writer strike that's still going on.
We got a writer strike that's going on, and I just want to, just some of the stuff that I've been keeping up on that front. You know, I go, like a lot of people, actually a lot of the writers who are on strike are keeping up, going to Nikki Fink's DeadlineHollywoodDaily.com.
Yeah.
And the one thing that really struck me today that was posted on there about 4 o'clock was that, you know, the writers' walkout so far, at the beginning of this week, there are 50 shows that have shut down. I think by the end of the week it will be over 100 shows.
Oh. Yeah, I know that these studios, these networks have a backlog of only a few shows. I mean, you're talking 6 episodes of Chuck, 6 episodes.
Yeah,
of
I mean, you're talking the
so
end of
there,
the year.
So there will be no February sweeps as we know them.
Yeah, I mean, HBO might come out a big winner because of The Wire is done, and that starts in January, but I don't know. That's the only show I can think of that's not going to be affected because it's done, it's all ready to go, but it's going to be a lot of reality television and game shows.
Yeah, yeah. God knows we need more of those.
No, we don't need more of those, and I just, you know, it's not like it was back in 88, and you'll have to forgive me, because I was a freshman in college when that was going on, so my mind was elsewhere, not always on the shows that were coming on, but I do remember it had economic devastating effects of Los Angeles, and I can only imagine a month or two of this will have horrendous effects on Los Angeles.
It has to.
Yeah.
We'll be talking more about the writer strike. We've actually spoken to a few screenwriters and authors in the past few shows about
we
have a guest this Sunday, Pamela Douglas, who is talking about her book, Writing the TV Drama, which is a great book, by the way. And we'll get some information from her from an insider's perspective.
Yeah, I welcome that, because we're just getting stuff like stories all over the place here, and I can't verify any of this.
Yeah. Yeah, that's true. They say that Schwarzenegger is getting in the middle of it. They say that they called another emergency meeting. They're begging for some sort of compromise because but at the same time, before the strike came on, I read something interesting today. The studios purchased a ton of scripts. I mean, Universal, I believe, spent $40 million on like 20 scripts.
Oh, yeah, they stocked up like crazy.
Yeah.
But here's my question to you then we'll probably get a better answer on Sunday. But, okay, let's say you buy all these scripts and everything. But what, you know, a lot of actors aren't going to cross the lines to do. I mean, this thing, I can't imagine. It just seems like I don't see the actors crossing the lines. And really, I'm really impressed with.
Yeah,
what
I mean, Ellen DeGeneres.
Shows.
Ellen DeGeneres is getting a lot of flack because she's actually going on with her show.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's amazing. I wanted to discuss. How we've made national news.
Yeah, I think we should do that because this is fascinating. I guess it started. I didn't know anything about it till Monday night. I just like was surfing around as I normally do.
Yeah,
you know, trolling the internet for everything. But I stopped. I saw something about Poltergeist on BloodyDisgusting.com, and of course I hit the link and it went directly to our show.
Yeah,
I was in a state of shock. But
well, the show was an interview with Michael Grace.
Yeah.
It can be accessed through Archive. It was our last show to celebrate the 25th anniversary of Poltergeist. And Michael Grace had co-written the screenplay to the first Poltergeist and co-written and produced the sequel. We asked him about this long gestating rumor that there's a Poltergeist 4 in the works. It says in development in his resume on IMDb. He said, it was a treatment I wrote a couple of years ago, and nothing's happened with it. And that was it. I mean, that was pretty much the end of that discussion.
Yeah.
So it was started running on the website, the rumors that there could be another Poltergeist. Listen to this Michael Grace interview. And it got picked up on 5 or 6 of the highest profile movie sites. And then finally, the next day, MGM, I believe, announced their plans for a remake of Poltergeist. Now, I'm thinking this isn't coincidence. They probably were propelled to make the announcement prematurely because as a result of our show, the story
right.
is circulating. So in our own little meager way.
We have done something that's either... it's going to be a remake, though. Oh.
Yeah. But coming up, I mean, expect world domination from us in the future.
Yeah, really.
Because we're on fire now.
We are.
We actually have Aaron on the phone. Let me pick up the slide and see what
All right, cool.
say real quick. I believe this is Aaron. Is it Aaron?
Yes, it is.
Hey,
what's up?
I'm thinking today, Poltergeist, obviously we got the ball rolling. I think we should focus our attention on a little more obscure films and get remakes and sequels done, and I'm going to nominate Zorro the Gay Blade that we highlight next.
Will George Hamilton come back for a cameo?
No, forget cameo. He's going to come back. The lead.
Oh, my.
He's going to come back in the lead, and it's going to be bigger, better, badder than ever.
And that blade will be more gay than ever before.
Yes, it'll. I'm telling you, box office. I mean, if Hairspray can do $100 million, Zorro the Gay Blade can do at least 150.
You heard it here first.
Wow. Well, thank you for that input.
But yeah, I was kind of stunned on the how just basically a 2-minute exchange of asking Michael Grace, well, we hear you wrote a treatment. You know, how's that coming along? And all he basically says, I wrote a treatment a few years ago, don't know anything about it. They've been mulling other versions around. He goes, but nothing, they haven't contacted me. There's 2 minutes of a conversation that really doesn't say anything concrete, and all of a sudden the Internet goes...
Well, and because I was under the impression that there was not anything concrete to say.
Yeah.
His whole point of perspective,
right.
There's nothing concrete. I mean, nothing came of it.
Yeah, you know, everyone kept... First, Internet rumors saying Poltergeist 4 is coming, and then the next day MGM is announcing Poltergeist 4 is coming, or Poltergeist Revamp, or Reimagining, or Remake, however they want to spin it.
Right.
So, it's pretty interesting. That's why I think the power that we have, we could keep up momentum.
Yeah, that's true. That's true. But looking at some of these, because we have home entertainment connections, thanks to Aaron now. He's been working really hard getting us guests and films to spotlight in our home video DVD spotlight. We keep getting these mailings, and we got one today with a special millennium edition of I Spit on Your Grave. Do you think we have the power to bring that film back?
You know what?
That's a cult film.
I don't know if
we
have the power, but I think we bear the responsibility of at least trying.
That's right.
To bring it back. I think if we work hard enough and it does get a minimum theatrical re-release, at the very least, Roger Ebert will get his voice back.
Okay. Well,
he'll just start screaming
because he feels very passionately opposed to that film. Right.
Okay. What do you guys think of the other? I guess the big news then really is the Friday the 13th remake news.
Yeah.
I really didn't care for the remake of Chainsaw Massacre. I know it actually has some fans and say, on its own, it's actually pretty good. So I have a feeling the Friday the 13th remake will probably have some fans, and I'm sure it'll actually have. You know, let's not kid ourselves. The first one had no pacing, had no rhythm, had no really decent acting. So I'm sure the remake will at least have rhythm, pacing, and decent actors. So right there, it's definitely better than the original.
Well, I remember the first three, it's like the first three or four, very actually, especially the first two were very scary. And then as a series, like any of these series that go on,
right.
it's hard, you know, it gets harder and harder to take them to be scared. The monsters become icons.
You know, when there's 10 of something,
yes.
10 or 11 of something, is there anything new to say about it?
Well, remember,
we're looking at the Bond films now, and we're like, oh, he's more, the Bond character is a lot more pouty in this one. I mean, that's these are the kind of changes that we point to after.
Yeah, it's hard. No, I agree with you. It's hard to keep something fresh, although I got to give the Bond credit, at least for trying. This happens, though. Jamie. This is going to happen. We're going to see all these things are getting remade or reimagined, whatever words you want to use.
It's incredibly short attention span. If to be remaking a film that's 25 years old, Poltergeist, you know, and people.
Well, I don't think the duration of time is really that much something to worry about. I mean, it was 22 years between the 56 Body Snatchers and the 78 Body Snatchers. So I don't think time's a problem. It's just, what are you choosing to remake, and are you bringing anything new to it? And frankly, Friday the 13th was just a poor man's Halloween, and it wasn't very good, and made in Canada because it was cheaper, and it was just terrible. And like I said, I actually do think that the remake is probably going to be better paced, have better editing rhythm, it'll be better directed, and the performances will be competent. So right there, I think it'll actually be
well,
better.
You know, so was Shakes the Clown compared to Friday the 13th.
But the thing is, and you've got to go back and...
I don't know, but Jason has a... among horror fans,
yeah.
I mean, Jason has a special place, so I can definitely see the outrage, and,
yeah.
You know, because Michael Bay is attached to it, and, you know, and people are really directing their venom towards the director, Marcus Nespel, who did Pathfinder and the remake of the Texas Chainsaw Massacre.
Has there been any rumblings of Kane Hodder being the returning as Jason?
Oh, I don't know.
It could be. I mean, he's still up and slashing.
And you got to remember, back in the day, the late 70s, early 80s, they were, what do you call it, you know, when they were hitting number 3, that's when they brought out the 3D, Amityville 3D, it was
right.
Friday the 13th 3D,
right.
Jaws 3D.
You know, it's interesting to me how the subjects that they choose for horror films that are based around teenagers. You know, Neo on the chat line right now is basically saying, you know, Friday the 13th is just have sex, get killed, which is essentially what it is. But there's a reason for it, because for teenagers, they're petrified, whether they want to admit it or not, by sex. They haven't experienced it yet. It's new to them. It scares them. These movies play off of that fear. But you're thinking about adult fears. Adult fears are afraid of a world where your children aren't safe, you know,
mm-hmm.
those kinds of things.
Providing
so,
for your children.
That's
yeah.
why I think Death Proof doesn't get enough respect for taking the conventions of the slasher films, whether it's, you know, the whole group of women, most of them being distracted, there's one girl who seems to be a little more investigative about their and aware of danger around them, but no one is really paying attention. And Tarantino brilliantly kind of subverts all the conventions and setups of a slasher film, and
yeah.
really does an amazing job. I don't think people give him enough credit with Death Proof on how accurate he was in adhering to slasher film conventions and then pulling the rug out from under them.
Right. I agree with that. I mean, no, people don't give the film enough credit for a number of reasons, and that's definitely one of them. But I don't know. We'll see. Friday 13th, you know, it has a special place in a lot of horror fans' hearts. I understand that. I just don't see the need to go back and mess with it.
I'm just curious, is there a Friday the 13th next year on the calendar? Because obviously that's when they'll try to...
what we're trying to do is, because if you remember, we recently, for our Texas Chainsaw Massacre tribute, we spoke to cinematographer Daniel Pearl, and Daniel Pearl photographed that first remake that Marcus Nespel did of Chainsaw, and he is Nespel's cinematographer.
Right.
They're a collaborative team. They go everywhere together. So we're going to try to get Marcus on the show to get...
I was curious to see what he wants to do, what they're going to try to do with it.
Well, I think
you can't go cheesy. I mean, and believe me, the first one is cheese, and that might be why a lot of people like it. But anyone that
there's something innocent about it, almost.
Yes,
yeah.
but it can't go that way because horror is a little different nowadays. It's got to be ugly. I mean,
well, it's got to be better lit. So I mean, the lighting in those Friday the 13th films, like I said, up in Canada, I guess they couldn't afford bulbs, and you know, the lighting was bad. So I'm expecting a better...
Even back then, they were going green in Canada. So far ahead of us.
What we ought to do is try to get a Friday... You know, we did a Chainsaw Massacre reunion. We ought to do a Friday the 13th reunion show to try to see if we can get...
you know, we tried, but Kevin Bacon wasn't available.
Yeah. Well, there's always Betsy Palmer and...
She makes the rounds, just like Michael Behrman. Believe me,
and
when we were planning our horror movie month, I contacted everybody. There is, believe it or not, there is a massive book on the Friday the 13th series.
Yes, by Peter M. Brack.
Yeah.
Right,
like
right.
An $80 collection, hardcover. It's gorgeous.
He used to edit the still very good website, DVD File, and they still do pretty good DVD. But he apparently, from the rumblings I've heard, so don't quote me, that Friday the 13th was a real passion project, and he left to do that. He's even on a couple of the commentaries on that Friday the 13th box.
Yeah,
right.
I mean, this is a serious book. I mean, it's and obviously he has a lot to write about because there's been like 10 movies, and all of them are the same, so I'm sure all the chapters are the same in the book. But but that's my take on it. So, Aaron, give us a sense. I told everyone at the top of the show what was going to be on this Sunday, but tell us who we got from Killer Sheep again.
Yes, Killer Sheep is a landmark American film that probably not many people have seen, or I'm sure even some have never even heard of. It was came out. It's shown in 1977, and it was one of those films that if you saw it, you never forgot it. But the director, Charles Burnett, a very, a terrific, very respected but unknown African-American filmmaker, he did it as a UCLA thesis film, and figuring that, you know, no one was really going to see it, it was only for his thesis project, he went all out when it came to the music, and so he couldn't...
It took a lot of time to get the rights for the...
Yeah,
right.
That's been
the
hold-up.
It cost $150,000.
But incredibly influential movie, and we have the lead actor.
Yes, we have Henry Sanders, who's going to be joining us for a half hour. We're going to talk about the Killer Sheep, the Charles Burnett collection. He's going to talk... He had the lead, and he's going to talk about the production, and I do want to stress on how important this film is that people probably don't know about, in that...
Yeah.
In 1990, when we got the first list of 50 films that were selected by the Library of Congress for preservation,
it was on it. Yeah.
Killer
yeah,
Sheep
right.
was on the first 50.
Well, we got to wrap things up. We got to premiere this track of from Lions of Lambs. Mr. Isham was so nice to let us premiere it tonight. Aaron, thanks for joining us tonight.
Yeah, thank you, Aaron.
Good night, fellas.
Talk to you on Sunday, Jerry. It's been a pleasure.
Likewise.
Once again. Special thanks to Tiffany Littleton for our opening announcement, and we will see you back here on Sunday night. Enjoy this little theme, this 2-minute clip here from Lions for Lambs, Mr. Mark Isham.